First, I'd like with great gladness to announce the publication, the republication of a book on Kōbun Chino Roshi's talks that Judy Cosgrove has been editing and refining this text for, I want to say 5 years or so, something like that.
Well, it's embarrassing, but it's longer than that.
this is a book of Kōbun, the founder of this temple, Kōbun Chino Roshi's Sesshin talks. So at certain times of the year, Jikoji, as well as other Zen centers, has an intensive time of meditation called a Sesshin. And these are talks that Kōbun Chino Roshi gave during the Sesshin that have to do with four topics are precepts. The precepts?
Well, the first topic is it's divided in four sections representing four different themes of Sesshin, which we have here. And first, I'm not sure it's not in the same order in which they occur, but the first one is celebration of the Buddha's birth. And the second, and it's called Tanjōe. And the next one is called Rohatsu, which is a celebration of his enlightenment. And the third one is
Nehane.
Tanjōe. The third one is
Denkoe.
So, what is that, about transmission?
Yeah. Denkoe.
Yeah. And the last one is Nehane, which is his final passing. And we have the precepts are presented, his conversations about the precepts are in that last one, contained in that last one.
And you have you've self-published these, or you have some copies?
I do, yes. Which will be up in the community room.
So, if anyone's interested, they're available. And there's some very fine teaching. Kōbun Chino Roshi was a good teacher, very good teacher. And if you'd like a copy, they're available there, I think.
There will be a little sign. It will say, take one, and then donation $16 or anything you can afford, basically. Because the emphasis is on taking one. Actually, I should have said read one. Take and read, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a wonderful morning. It feels almost like spring to me. Sunny, and I noticed coming down here, the smell from the kitchen was very fragrant and wonderful, so I'm already thinking about lunch. In the spirit of Kōbun Chino Roshi, I do have a topic. Perhaps we can get to it. But in the spirit of Kōbun Chino Roshi, he often opened up talks of this kind to questions and concerns that might exist. rather than presenting a topic. It's interesting, we, in this practice way, we have this very simple activity of sitting, walking, this practice way. And really, that's enough. We don't really have to say anything about it. Just like Orioki is this bowl, that this eating bowl, it means just enough, it's just right. The practice itself is enough. Sometimes to speak about it almost feels rude. And yet, that's our nature, isn't it? We talk a lot in this life and describe things a lot. And besides our talking with one another, golly, we have all this media coming at us. Have you noticed? It's quite an interesting mental texture we find ourselves in, of verbiage. So shall we end right there?
Sorry, I might interfere with what you had planned to talk about, but it's really been bothering me how much we emphasize perfection in our rituals, you know, in our chant and so on. We talk about the perfection, perfect. And of course, all I could think about is all the things that are wrong with that, you know, this morning.
With, you mean with your editing?
Yes.
And so on?
Yes. Everything about it, you know. But it's, why do we talk about perfection all the time?
In the sutra, it's sometimes called complete, perfect enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the Sanskrit is Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. And it translates as complete, perfect enlightenment. My understanding of Anuttara is not perfected, but more resolved or come to fruition. So, not so much that it is perfect in contrast to something that's imperfect or that's in development, but that it's thorough. Sometimes it's translated that way, as thorough, complete and thorough awakening, rather than perfect. Perfect is a problematic word, isn't it? For lots of people, for me too. Yeah.
I think the sutra also encourages not to set up standards of your own. Isn't there a line like that in one of the sutras?
In the Metta Sutra.
Don't set up standards of your own. So this kind of so perfect may not be with respect to a particular standard.
Maybe.
Well, I know Kogan used to talk about nothing extra. I think that was the phrase. Which I kind of prefer, in a way, to perfect.
Well, I witnessed perfection on Friday. I was watching the Warriors play, and they have a player, a sports hero, Clay Thompson. He had what could very well be called a perfect quarter of basketball. He made every shot that he attempted, and he attempted a lot. And his teammates also, when they saw that he was just rising to some level, they all just started giving him the ball. Yeah, it was just complete unselfishness on the part of the rest of the team. He set a new NBA record. And afterwards, the interview, they were comparing him with his, you know, they were praising him. And he said, well, this is really humbling for me. So he also had a perfect interview of mine afterwards. And I've been thinking about it since, and even in relation to what we do, Jonathan, you know, he was on that floor and he was just moving graciously and not thinking about anything but dribbling the ball, by shooting. You know, his mind is pervading his body, like when we really sit and put our complete mental and physical present into the moment, and he did that for the entire 12 minutes. He also stole balls and blocked shots. It was just an incredible thing to watch, and it's like you don't strive for perfection, but if you just, and this happens, of course, he's played basketball his whole life since he was a little kid, so there's lots of training that comes to them. Lots of training, and then
that comes to fruition.
Fruition, then, yeah. When you put your whole presence,
yeah,
then magical things can happen.
Yeah.
Without, in a way, you not even being there. You know,
yeah.
They asked him. He said, "Well, I don't know. After all, I just thought I was just going to shoot it." He says, "I was off balance, you know," and he's aware my feet were not on one shot, my feet were playing. So, you know, he's really aware of his body. But at a certain point, he's just kind of surrendering to the moment and throwing the basketball up in the air, and it's going through the hoop every time.
I'm on a golf game like that.
Yeah.
Don't worry, it's the intention. Just go out and intend to have a game with
them. The right aspiration, huh? Anatara Samyak Sambodhi. It sort of sets up it's a big deal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Thorough, complete.
Perfect.
Perfected in the sense that it's maybe refined, and to refined sometimes means to be put through the fire, right? To be tested, or to be maybe challenged, to be worked. You know? When you did your, you had lots of choices in this, didn't you? Like what to include and what not to include, and how to phrase, how to bring Coben's words into. So I bet many doubts came up about what should I say it this way, or should it be said this way, or should I include this? Yeah.
In our normal idea of perfection, I don't believe it exists, to tell the truth. And I don't believe what you saw was perfect. But there was something...
I believe it was. I believe it was.
There was something in you that felt perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a feeling. that felt perfect. And I'm not sure it had everything to do with that player, that basketball player. Something in you, I think.
In me, the moment was perfect. People in the crowd, the players, the coaches, even the other opposing players. So it was, concepts are just things we try to fit our experience to. I guess you, depending on what, how you're conceptualizing perfect and what that has to mean for you for it to be it, maybe for you it wouldn't be, but just in the moment being there, perfect is like the best word I could use to describe what was happening there. It was kind of a magical perfection. And I think there are times here that happens. In your city, you realize your perfection. And it's not a mathematical formula, analytic kind of thing. You experience it. So that's what I could see the sutras would say that.
In Buddhist understanding, this practice and the experience, the initial experience of the Buddha and the way the Buddha taught, and the way that Buddhist thought has come forward, one of the expressions of it is the middle way, Madhyamaka, the middle way. When I first heard that term, I thought of the middle way as a kind of way of moderation. And I heard the story of the Buddha. His first part of his life was a householder, was a very privileged life, and maybe even indulgent. He was overprotected childhood and very wealthy, and he was a spoiled rich kid, basically. And so in reaction to the shallowness or lack of fulfillment within that life, he went into the opposite extreme of asceticism and maybe seeking a perfect life, in this sense. He went into the activity of asceticism, of strict discipline, of control, of self-denial, of kind of a harsh, willful way to be perfect. And he failed in a certain sense. He didn't arrive at perfection that way. And he remembered, this is a really interesting story, he remembered a incident in his childhood when his father was a governor or a king in this small kingdom in northern India, the Shakya clan, and he remembered an incident when he was a young boy. His father was doing some ceremonial plowing to initiate the beginning of spring, and he was under a tree. Was it like a rose apple tree or some tree, some special tree? And he was in a state of need. He was in a state of well-being. He was in a state of ease, of repose and ease. He was in a state of happiness, and he watched his father plow, and he was in a state of what's called nirvikalpa jhana, non-discursive awareness. He was aware, he was clear, he was there, but he wasn't thinking about it. like the basketball player that was just doing, he was not trying to control the situation or think about it or describe it. He was in nirvikalpa jhana, non-discursive awareness. And when the Buddha was doing his ascetic practice, he remembered that incident. He was kind of at his last state. He was very emaciated from fasting and so on. He remembered this incident, and he decided that this disciplined way, this way to try to be perfect, was not the correct path. And he received food, and he restored his health, and he found this middle way that was a way that was not just middle in the sense of moderation, but it was middle in the sense that it was comprehensive. It included his whole life. In other words, like both his body and his mind. He started to take care of his body. He started to take care of himself as a sentient being, as a biological being. And that's when he really started to practice. And so we have this term from that experience, the middle way, the Madhyamaka, the middle way. I've also heard the middle way described as the non-contradiction of opposites. So in the non-contradiction of opposites, we have understanding that it's not just the way of asceticism, and it's not just the way of indulgence. It's both, and both of those do not contradict one another. It is the way of control and choice and intention and aspiration, and it is the way of release and letting go and accepting yourself just as you are. Both, and those two things do not contradict one another in this way of practice. Which is hard to get around, isn't it? I mean, we think it has to be one way or the other. Did you?
Yeah. Thinking maybe when we look at perfect, we want something that will outlast time. We have time, like we're looking for the one thing that will work all the time rather than maybe
something that's mutable and changing and conditioned.
Yeah, maybe that's what they're talking about in the sutra, that perfect is conditioned.
Unconditioned state. A state that's not affected doing something like that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about that. Like Lance kept saying, in this moment, and then maybe it wasn't, maybe that was the way through in that moment.
Thank you. Did you have something?
Yeah, are you done?
Yeah.
No, what he's talking about, it talks a lot in the scriptures about body mind as being perfect, but it's independent of form and characteristic. It doesn't have, you know, like the verse of the faith mind, it talks about the great way isn't difficult for those who have no preferences, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. You know, and it's a state of no mind where there really isn't anything particularly wrong or right. It's free of that discrimination. And that's really ultimately what the whole deal is aiming toward. You know, and be abiding in that, staying without mind or staying without picking and choosing and, judgment and stuff. And in my own practice, it's like what he's talking about, like willful effort. It's like, I'll sit here till my femurs blow out my kneecaps. I don't care. I'm an idiot when it comes to sitting zazen. But then I get out to my car, and the first thing I think about is, where's a cigarette? Where, you know, like, I still, you know, like, it's been, like, a hard road for, like, practice and stuff in regard to pushing myself to do something better or to be serious about practice, but also accepting myself for being, you know, having a mouth like a sailor and more bad habits than most people in this room put together. So, yeah, it's like, it's all, I'm not getting out of here alive, and I might as well just accept things as they are and find some degree of peace of mind in it all. So,
but, yeah, that sums it up.
That sounds perfect.
Just ended up at last week's talk again. Went to the Shinshin memory of that last week.
Okay.
They say that the Buddha woke up, whether this is true or not, but other descriptions, woke up in what's called the fourth jhana. The jhana, it's Sanskrit is upeksha. Upeksha means equanimity.
Woke up in that jhana? When he had his enlightenment, or?
Yeah, when he had his enlightenment, yeah. So the state, there's other formless jhanas as well in this description, but the first jhana is the jhana. The jhana means it's described as a kind of knowledge, but it also means practice. Might be best described as kind of practice, knowledge, kind of both those terms together. So jhana is actually the root of what Zen is. So jhana, in when it came to China, it became chana, and that was shortened to chan Buddhism. The Buddhism that focused on meditation, and then when it came to Japan, chan became Zen. The term became Zen. The school of meditation, the school of jhana. Anyway, the first jhana is the jhana of discursive awareness, where you're aware of something, and but you're also kind of you're describing it, or it has. Let's say it has an identity. It has context. It has description. The second jhana is the jhana of non-discursive awareness, where you're present, like the basketball player that just responded. It's just in the zone, right? Mm-hmm. Don't they call it the zone? They always call it the zone. Yeah.
So wherever that is.
Yeah. Wherever that zone is, yeah.
Where I want to be.
Yeah. Non-discursive awareness is you don't need to describe anything at all. You're just with whatever is happening and responding appropriately. And the third jhana is that state of non-discursive awareness with joy and ease and pleasure. It's actually a pleasurable state. But the fourth jhana is you actually drop off any sense of pleasure or well-being. It's you're neither suffering or you're not suffering. You're neither knowing or you're not knowing. You're both and neither. You're just at that poised state of presence. That's a picture. That's equanimity. That's where the Buddha woke up. He was in that state and he was finished. He finished it. He finished his work. Then he became the ta-ta-ta.
Yeah. Sorry. You said finished the work. like I noticed that phrase in particular, like if you say that at certain Zen places, people will freak out. But I just heard you say he finished the work. Can you, like, do you think that there is, to a degree, as long as we're in a body or whatever, we still got work to do. But do you think that to some degree there is a sense of resolution or completion that practitioners probably should be working for? Toward, or that's like a touchy subject between like the Soto and Rinzai stuff and willfully moving toward awakening and you know, kind of keeping and not know and see what happens, like the different styles of it. But if I could, like, this is my kind of first time spending time here, I want to see what your take is on it.
In the Pali Sutras, that's the way that the Buddha described himself. I have done what had to be done. I finished the work. I've completed the task. And the term that was used for the Buddha was the tathata, the one who has thus gone the way, or finished the way, or completed the way of the Buddha, of the Buddhas. So it sounds like something was resolved, something was finished, and that's what I was referring to. Now, whether it's a whole other topic to say whether there's any completion in the sense of having a goal toward, you know, having to make Zazen a project or an assignment that has a finish. You finish the assignment at the last, you know, thing, and then you're done. That sounds like messy. It sounds like it's off to me. Yeah.
No, I wasn't referring to that. Just, I see what you're saying, but just the seeker itself, or the one who is, if that is the case, who is moving toward Zazen as a goal, actually gets extinguished. So it doesn't happen that the seeker reaches the goal, but the foundation from which the seeker would be standing on kind of falls out. And in that, there's a...
Absolutely. Drop off the bottom, if you can. Yeah. Let the bottom of the bucket fall off. Good luck. I mean, that would be good luck to have the bottom drop off. Then you could see what's next.
Just tell me that Clay Thompson's not going to retire now.
Poured a little slab here, and I talked to my friend Brian, and I said, "Yeah, we're finished the slab." And he said, "We're never done." And we just laughed because that's how it always is. We're never done, and yet you're finished with that you did, that you do, and there's always more. Lots more.
If you're still alive, if you're still breathing. Huh? If you're still alive and breathing, yeah. And then who knows? Maybe you're still not finished. Yeah.
I was horrified when my teacher told me, Dharma translation, that's it, you're finished. And I thought, oh no, really? And then she said, you finished that part and the rest goes on forever. And I'm like, oh yeah. It doesn't ever end.
Rinzai Roku, Rinzai Roku talks about settling all your doubts, or removing all your doubts. So I think it's that kind of completion. You see your perfection, and it removes your doubts about your life, your place, the being, the importance.
Mm.
Doesn't mean your practice ends.
Mm.
You know, that there's not still further to look and investigate and because the mystery is just never ending. It's not like you find an answer. now it stops. But you see that in the looking itself, there's a tremendous fulfillment. And so you just keep on going with that. That's the way I resolve, since I practice both Rinzai and Sogo. That's my resolution to this sort of ongoing debate.
And you can in that context, there is also the non-contradiction of opposites.
Yes.
It reminds me of the story of Basho, Master Ma. He was a... you probably know Ma.
I know.
He was a... apparently, as the story comes down to us, he was this really physical, big guy. And he was an imposing presence. He was... had many, many disciples, and he was greatly feared because he was so strong and so emphatic in his teachings. And apparently he could shout to help his students wake up so loud that he would make some of his students deaf. he was a force. Anyway, the story goes that one time Master Ma was unwell. Master Ma, instead of being this strong physical presence, Master Ma was kind of not, he wasn't available as his ferocious self. He was sick. And one of the administrators of the temple came into, and this is a scary guy. He came in very cautiously to ask how Master Ma was doing with his illness. And how is the venerable teacher's health these days, or something like that, he asked. And Master Ma said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. There's a sutra of the many names of the Buddha, recitation of the many names of the Buddha, and in that sutra, the sun-faced Buddha is the Buddha that lives like 1,088 years, basically lives forever, basically is strong and powerful and cannot be extinguished. It's the Buddha, the sun-faced Buddha is the Buddha of power, the Buddha of manifestation, the Buddha who cannot be extinguished. That's sun-faced Buddha. And the moon-faced Buddha is this Buddha that just lives a day and a night. It's just like this flickering Buddha, this frail, trembling little, soon born and soon died Buddha. So when the attendant asked Master Ma how he was feeling, he said, "So-so, good and bad." he actually responded from a place of equanimity. I'm powerful. I'm still powerful, this powerful teacher, and I'm helpless, and I'm about to die. I'm both. So that was a great teaching for that state became a public case, and great teaching for us, that we are our fragile, helpless, stupid, problematic, petty little selves, and we're Buddhas. And when we sit down on this seat, we become a Buddha, and we do not abandon our ordinary self. Both of them sit down together and get up together and meet the world. So let's do that. Let's have lunch and be a Buddha and an ordinary being. Oh.